The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this episode, we'll dig a little deeper into the October issue of Our State Magazine, featuring articles all about North Carolina's mountain region, Healing After Helene. And the first article is called Appalachia Rising. A performance by an Asheville dance company illustrated the healing power of music and movement for both choreographer and audience. Whenever someone brings up Hurricane Helene, Heather Malloy winces at the memory. Buildings gone, downed trees everywhere, the French Broad River turning into a sea that engulfed everything she recognized. I can't stay here, she told herself. But what could she do? She couldn't clear brush or move dirt or repair damaged houses. When she came back to Asheville, she found her answer. She could turn post-Helene mess into metaphor. As the founder and artistic director of Asheville's Terpsichore Theater of Dance, she created Appalachian Phoenix, a performance that evokes the trauma and emotion inflicted by the storm, showing audiences how movement and music can deliver a message of hope and healing. Yet Malloy still struggles with her life following Helene. She left. Others, like her husband, stayed. She felt she didn't do enough. Others did. She wanted to help more, to be more, but she felt so helpless. On a summer night in Asheville, moments after Terpsichore dancers previewed excerpts of the show for Helene volunteers, whom Malloy calls heroes, she found herself in a conversation with one of those heroes, Lark Frazier. Malloy mentioned her post-Helene angst. "Gosh, I felt so bad," she told Frazier. "I couldn't do anything." "But Heather, you're the storyteller," Frazier said. "Your time is now. Those who were comfortable jumping on the front lines did so. Our time is over. Now it's time for the next wave of people to carry the story forward." When Helene barreled into Asheville last fall, Malloy took her 12-year-old son Zane to stay with a friend in Charleston, South Carolina. After 2 weeks, they came back and began volunteering at a distribution site in a parking lot in Swannanoa. She sifted through mounds of clothes and called various nonprofits to find a home for what she saw. She figured the organizations needed clothing. They didn't. They already had too much. After more than a dozen calls, Malloy began to brainstorm. She didn't want the clothes dumped in the landfill, and she began thinking of what to do. Then it hit her. She saw so many clothes, so many blue clothes. Blue, water, rivers, rising. What about all those half-liter water bottles? The bottoms of the bottles looked like flowers to her. If she could get enough, she thought, she could make a big translucent backdrop. Malloy recruited Zane and his friends to collect all the blue clothes they could find. She asked the community to drop off empty water bottles on her porch. She even put out a press release. Those half-liter bottles had become the post-Helene symbol of when Western North Carolina spent months without potable water. They also became a symbol of the waste left behind after the storm. She wondered if she'd get enough. She ended up with 15,000 bottles, enough to fill 300 trash bags. This, she told herself, may work. Back in June of 2003, during the first Terpsichore performance, Malloy walked on stage at Asheville's Diana Wortham Theater and addressed the 250 or so in the auditorium. "Are you loving what you're seeing?" she asked. "Well, I don't have any money to pay these dancers, but Asheville deserves to have something like this, so I need your help." She got it. Malloy raised enough money to pay for that show and the next one later that summer. Over the next 22 years, she created a successful program that has drawn a devoted audience and attracted talented dancers from near and far. When many dance companies closed for the summer, dancers seek out Terpsichore because it's a paid gig that keeps them in shape, hones their techniques, and immerses them in Malloy's style of storytelling. She doesn't create pretty shows. She digs into dark storylines and tackles tough issues. Her programs may not always have literal narrative, but most have a lot of humor. Her dancers love that. In the creative, trusting atmosphere she and her rehearsal director, Christopher Bandy, have built, she perseveres. Always has. Growing up in a farmhouse in Pinnacle, she would pull dress-up clothes from her closet, dance in her gold lamé go-go boots, and let her imagination fly. When her parents divorced and her mom later moved them to Winston-Salem, she began setting goals that seemed unattainable, even to her mom. But she always reached them. She got into the University of North Carolina School for the Arts and danced as Clara in the Sugar Plum Fairy and the Nutcracker. After graduation, she joined the North Carolina Dance Theater, now Charlotte Ballet, and moved to Charlotte. A year later, she choreographed her first piece. She scored more work as a choreographer, and in 2003, she moved to Asheville. I remember when she called and said, "Okay, I'm going to open a dance company in Asheville." And part of me wanted to say, "That is the most ridiculous statement anyone has ever made," her mom Judy says today. "But I've told her since the time she could breathe that she could do anything, and I've always been behind her with whatever she did. Like turning blue clothes into 30-foot ropes that represent rivers and resilience, or using 13,000 water bottles to create a backdrop that glistens in a waterfall of white light. Or envisioning how trash can become the bedrock of a 25-minute, seven-movement performance that premiered in July in Asheville and Winston-Salem. It's this visualization thing she has, and it's a strange thing to watch," Judy says. She'll look at everything, decide what she wants to do, and just does it. One night last spring, sitting at her dining room table, Malloy opened her laptop and the structure and flow of the story came in a rush. As she wrote, she cried, and all those tough Helene memories came crashing back. She once again wanted to do what seemed impossible, have Appalachian Phoenix say so much without saying a word. "Hi, I'm Heather. Thanks for coming." Malloy circles the room, meeting the volunteers who've gone above and beyond since Helene. She's woven their stories into Appalachian Phoenix, and on this night in July, in the last hour of a six-hour rehearsal in downtown Asheville, more than a dozen volunteers have arrived for a preview. Malloy asks them to tell their stories. The dancers sit close by. She's told them stories about Helene, and they've done their own research, but what they hear has them transfixed. On the eve of their first public performance, after 3 weeks of rehearsal, the dancers listen to the harrowing details about Helene and realize their enormous responsibility. Their performance has to ring true. "Each movement represents a lot of different heroes," Malloy tells volunteers after their storytelling session, "and I hope you see a little bit of what you did and what you felt in each one." The dancers take their places. In the second segment, anchored by A Thousand Hands, written and sung by local musician Chris Rosser, they stretch four ropes of clothing across the stage, across the studio. They wrap themselves in fabric, which represents the rivers that became oceans during Helene. As A Thousand Hands moves from 1 minute to two, the dancers pull shirts from the rivers to help dress one another in slow motion, illustrating what Malloy saw and felt after Helene. At a time when death and despair felt like ever-present companions, neighbors and strangers comforted and helped one another. A thousand hands, stretch across a fallen land. When fortune turns the ground to sand, love demands a thousand hands. As the volunteers watch, some sit ramrod straight and wear the weary look often seen in war veterans. Others sit stoop-shouldered, looking at their hands and their laps. Memories are still fresh. During the next excerpt, Restoring Hope, dancers become circus performers. They juggle water bottles, twirl like tops, holding water jugs. balance water jugs on their heads, and toss water bottles like baseballs to one another. One dancer crab walks across the floor with a shrink-wrapped bundle of water bottles under her arm and another behind her knees. One little boy watches, and he just laughs. Mikey is 4. He's one of Malloy's heroes. Before the preview, she asks him what he did after Helene. He doesn't say a word. Malloy fills in the blanks, asking if what she heard was true, that he grabbed a shovel, put on his Batman gloves, joined adults in his Asheville neighborhood, and helped a family dig through a mudslide, blocking their driveway. He nods. Malloy tells Mikey that a dancer from Philadelphia plays him in the show, and that same dancer is about to perform in Restoring Hope. Mikey perks up and allows his mom to move him up front, feet from dancers. He leans hard into his mom's side and waits for the dancers to begin. So remember her name, not for riches or fame, but for giving back joy in a world soaked in rain. From the heart of the wreckage to the soul of a child, she left hope behind when the storm once smiled. Now I feel safe. Throughout the two-minute segment, fueled by a hip-hop beat and a seesawing violin in a song by local vocalist Daytrian Johnson, the audience laughs. Mikey laughs so hard he doubles over, squeezing his eyes shut, rocking back and forth. The laughter cuts the tension, and when Restoring Hope ends, the volunteers, Malloy's heroes, stand up looking more relaxed. Malloy looks more relaxed as well. Another of Malloy's heroes, Lark Frazier, organized what she called the Poop Crew. She and others spent nearly 2 weeks raising money and gathering supplies to teach those without running water how to make a dry toilet out of a 5-gallon bucket, a trash bag, and a handful of sawdust. She and her crew handed out about 1,000 makeshift toilets and several hundred partial supplies. At the preview, Frazier can't get over what she saw. The thing that stood out the most was 1,000 hands, she said. When I saw everyone on stage dressing each other, I started crying. I kept thinking, oh my gosh, that's exactly how it felt in the aftermath of the storm. Everywhere you looked, you saw people helping people. Frazier sits up front. Christy Thrift and her husband Scott sit in the back row. Christy stands up during the preview, filming excerpts on her iPhone and wiping tears from her eyes. The Thrifts run North Carolina Outdoor Adventures in Bakersville. After Helene, they helped evacuate their neighbors, delivering food and medicine to people who needed it, and created a GoFundMe page to help struggling families in western Mitchell County. The couple raised $272,000. Today they're continuing to clean up the North Toe River, and they set up a nonprofit called Resilient Appalachia Disaster Relief Fund, RAD Relief for short, to raise money for river and flood mitigation, stream bank restoration, and a child's emergency preparedness program. The dancers in Appalachian Phoenix, Christy says, are crucial armor. The dancers are educators of emotion. Hearing the volunteers' stories has enriched their performances, delivering to Western North Carolina a message it needs to hear. With dance, there are no words, Christy says. It lets your mind wander and puts it where it needs to be. Healing. Jeff Ewing understands. He lives in Asheville, lived through Helene, and spent time delivering food and water to distribution sites for nearly a month after the storm. In his 11th season with Terpsichore, Malloy picked him to play the show's biggest role, the symbol of the suffering and resiliency in Western North Carolina. Ewing is the phoenix of Appalachia. Leading up to the final movement, Ewing reaches for help, his body limp, dancers encircling him like family. Johnson steps on stage and sings, "I'll Fly Away." The music picks up. Dancers fly around one another, and Ewing leaps and twirls before climbing up a staircase of dancers' backs. He raises his arms like wings, and that's where Appalachian Phoenix ends. After every season, Malloy asks herself, "Why do I do this?" This year, her answer is more poignant. Nearly 2,000 people came to see Appalachian Phoenix, and the 8 performances accomplished what she had hoped. The community came together, reflected on what had happened, and thought about how they help others heal and heal themselves. As Malloy asked Malloy about Helene, and her reaction immediately after the storm still gnaws at her, but ask her about what's next, and her voice brightens. She talks about the ropes of clothes, the backdrop of water bottles, and her idea of resurrecting Appalachian Phoenix to reach more people. She doesn't know how yet, but she will find a way. Our next article after in the Mountain Strong series is Picking Up the Pieces. After the storm, an old Fort artist gathered what was broken and made something beautiful. Omi Saliva's collection of trash began with three nails. It wasn't like Salavia, an artist in the mountain town of Old Fork, had been collecting debris for a trash-to-treasure project. It was more that she felt compelled to pick up each piece to keep it from doing more damage. At the time, she didn't realize she was about to embark on an adventure and bring a community with her. Just a few weeks after Helene, when Salavia returned to her day job at the McDowell County Visitor Center to inspect her office, the heads of three roofing nails in the parking lot caught her eye. She bent down and picked them up. "I didn't want them to ruin somebody's day," she said. Salavia dropped the nails on the corner of her makeshift desk. Over the coming days, without even thinking, she added to the pile bolts, shards of glass, parts of old insulator from a fallen power line. Eventually, she added them to tall drinking glasses and jars. "It was my coping mechanism, I think. Some of us had our art studios destroyed. Others of us were left homeless," she said. "Almost everybody is waiting for a paycheck and can't afford a flat tire. Despite a natural disaster, real life still happens." As an artist, Salavia often hears the sentiment that tragedy sparks creativity. But there's a time when you're like, how do I process this? For Salavia, the answer came well after Helene. "I just sat there at my desk and stared into the glass," she says. "It was an oddly sunny day, and the sun captured a piece of aqua glass just right," she says. "I realized it had been 2 months since I'd physically made anything." Omi Salavia's healing through Helene's sculpture collection began with a skull. Salavia admits she has a bit of a reputation. "My normal art is described as spooky and granny witch style," she says with a laugh. "I go out into the woods and look for plants and mushrooms that I can dry and then turn into resin skulls. Made from a mold I use a lot. To me, skulls represent finality and attaining wisdom." Typically, September is one of Salavia's prime foraging months, but Helene stripped away the topsoil, taking the microbial network where mushrooms grow with it. As she gazed into the glass of trash on her desk, the sun gleaming off the aqua glass, inspiration struck, and Salavia thought about her skull mold and the possibilities it held. It was time to dust it off and get back to making. Salavia shared with a colleague her first sculpture, a resin skull with sparkling pieces she'd collected. "My coworker said, 'That is beautiful, but also very creepy. People feel dreary and they need hope.'" The conversation then turned to bluebirds. "After Helene, a few weeks went by without the sound of birds," she said. "In Southern folklore, the bluebird represents happiness. So Salavia brought a bird figurine from a local consignment shop and cast a mold, small enough to fit in the nest of your palm. Into the mold went an assortment of trash, buckles from old shoes, pages of books lost to the floodwaters, glass from broken bottles. Then she poured the resin. By the end of the weekend, I'd made 4 bluebirds and a skull. When she held each bluebird up to the light, the sun reflected through her found objects. To Salavia, they represented hope. I decided I would give these bluebirds of happiness to our community," she says. Omi Salavia's gift to Old Fort began with an adventure. Tucked along the southern edge of Pisgah National Forest, Old Fort's peaceful soundtrack, insects chirping, birds singing, and water tumbling over rocks at Mill Creek and the Catawba River, is familiar to hikers. Almost all of the town's trails closed following Helene, but over the past year, volunteers and Forest Service personnel cleared trees and removed debris, making many accessible again. One of Salovea's favorite places to walk is a path between the Mountain Gateway Museum and the Old Fort Library. There's a small mosaic garden at the library and one of those neat signs that shows how far the library is from imaginary places and books, like the Shire and Narnia, she says. Here, she adds, you can forget everything for a moment and find a little peace. It was the perfect hiding place for Salvea's scavenger hunt. She hid a bluebird sculpture in the little free library and shared clues to find it on her Instagram at omi.salvea. As her social media engagement grew, Salvea expanded the hunt to the neighboring town of Little Switzerland. Her goal? Drive people to beautiful places that over the last year experienced devastation and rebirth. One of those destinations is Arrowhead Gallery and Studio at Old Fort, which reopened in a bigger space with room for artists beside the visitor center. They went through all the tough stuff we all went through, and they have room to thrive, she says. Since Helene, Salovea has hidden more than 20 sculptures, all love letters to her chosen mountain home. Her goal is to hide and give away at least 30 sculptures by the storm's anniversary. Salovea's scavenger hunt clues have led to places like Mill Creek and downtown Old Fort, to events like Rail and Rhythm's Bluegrass Night, and to local landmarks like the Arrowhead Monument at the historic train depot where she hid a small resin heart. The point wasn't that the Arrowhead was the heart of town, Salovea says, but that the heart of this town is change and growth. In our hearts, that growth makes us. Departing from our Mountain Strong segment, I will turn again to the North Carolina State Fair with another article that may be interesting to those of you who might be going this week. One Bite at a Time, a food writer explores the North Carolina State Fair for the first time and finds a buffet of global tastes hiding in plain sight. When you're 40 feet in the air above the North Carolina State Fair with your feet dangling over unsuspecting humans, food trucks, and whirling rides below, it's not a great time to suddenly remember that you're afraid of heights. Especially not when you have a spoon in one hand and a cup of Lebanese-style ice cream in the other. Creamy, gooey, stretchy, and topped with pistachios and extra stiff cotton candy. As my stomach gave a warning lurch, I closed my eyes, clung to the thin metal bar that stood between me and potential disaster below, and reluctantly put my spoon back in the cup. I'd have to wait for the State Fair flyer to deliver me back to Terra Firma before I risk another bite. A fairgrounds regular might have known better, but that's why I was there. I'm the farthest thing from being a North Carolina State Fair veteran. In more than 30 years covering food events all over the state, I've judged countless contests, barbecue to biscuits to municipal drinking water. I've picked grapes at the Biltmore Estate Winery and apples on hilltops all over western North Carolina. I've coaxed soft-shelled crabs out of their shells on the coast and watched milk turn into cheese pretty much everywhere there are pastures. But eat my way through the state fair? Not once. It wasn't my territory. I spent my work decades at the Charlotte Observer, nearly 170 miles from the state fairgrounds. My compatriot, Andrea Weigel, over at the News and Observer in Raleigh, got the yearly assignment to revel in funnel cakes and deep-fried monstrosities. It's only been in the past couple of years that I've found myself semi-retired with the freedom to spend an October day anywhere I like. I can finally grab the reins, catch a train, and head east in search of ham biscuits, blue ribbons, and all the sugar-coated fun a girl can fit into an afternoon. Food at state fairs seem like they should be frozen in time, all cotton candy, candy apples, and corn dogs. And those things are still there. My favorite part of the fair is what I call the Museum of Dead Food, the cases and cases of pies, cookies, cakes, and candies wearing blue, white, and red ribbons. I saw pies with crusts that sport entire Bible verses, cakes wrapped in winter scenes so snowy they'd never actually exist in a temperate North Carolina December. After they're judged, they stay on display for the entire 11 days of the fair and then presumably go into the bin, too stale to be eaten. A pity, but the time people put toward constructing baked goods into artworks No one gets to eat makes me pause with respect and give a silent salute. Still, a bigger surprise was waiting when I stepped into the state fair world. While I wasn't looking, fair food went international. Oh, there are still butter-slathered ears of roasted corn and peach cobbler wrapped in a pizza cone. I braved a 38-minute wait in one line for four ribs and a basket of fries from the Lawrence and Perry barbecue truck from Warren County. The ribs were $23, but they were tender, smoky, and moist. I'd have been proud to have made them on my Weber grill at home. Walking along the midway, though, I spotted a world I didn't expect. Brazilian bowls and something called Safari Eats that served Kenyan barbecue. Magdalena's chimney cakes, a Hungarian treat with pastry wrapped around a stick, grilled in front of a fire, and then filled with whipped cream or ice cream, and reminded me of a hollow version of New York's beloved cronut. At one stand, I could have chosen between a Cuban sandwich and an empanada. At another, there were cheesy Korean corn dogs. There was a Lebanese stand, Niamand, where I could have picked lamb nachos or kale shawarma. Instead, I went with Betty's Bouza, stretchy Lebanese ice creams, topped with white cotton candy so stiff it looked like it had been clipped from one of the founding fathers' wigs. I was so overwhelmed, I took my Lebanese creation with its varied textures and creamy tanginess and climbed into a chairlift for a ride over the fairgrounds while I contemplated the wonder of it all. Even though I had to contemplate with my eyes squeezed shut while my Middle Eastern ice cream melted in its cup, I still took heart at the sheer creative variety of feasts below. Even better, most of these businesses have a local presence in our state capital. Good for you, Raleigh. Today's fair food captures something I love about America, the way we bring all the tastes and traditions of an entire planet together in one place and make them our own. Who needs a funnel cake when you can get a Jamaican jerk pork belly bayo and a plate of kimchi nachos and chase it all down with an acai and dragon fruit bowl? When the state fair flyer brought me back to earth with my cup of Lebanese-style ice cream in hand, I was ready to watch some 4-H kids lead their homegrown sheep around a show ring. Maybe next time they'll bring llamas. Looking at a couple of pictures here and the insets, whether you're craving international cuisine like Golden K dogs, Korean corn dogs, or traditional fair like cotton candy and caramel apples, the NC State Fair has you covered. Visitors to the State Fair can start their day with a country ham biscuit from Pittsburgh Kiwanis Club booth, a fixture at the fair for more than 60 years, and finish with a freshly fried funnel cake. Sorry, I'm moving back here. And then there's if you plan to eat your way through the scores of food vendors at this year's State Fair, be sure to wait to save room for one of Magdalena's Hungarian chimney cakes. And I'm going to try to describe this to you. It looks like a circular homemade cone, a little bit wider at the top. And then there's a layer of looks like chocolate fudge and then ice cream on top. And there's something dripping down, which probably is a caramel of sorts. And we have one picture left of the Dorton Arena, side view of the Dorton Arena. That'll wrap us up. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. So long till next time.